Thanks. Yeah, so what you're seeing here on the screen is a movie of one of my simulations on the galaxy simulator. This is sort of the cosmic web shown here in green, and the colors are hot gas that's being ejected from dwarf galaxies due to supernova feedback. The white is very, very hot, and you can see it sort of turns red as it expands and cools down, and it really sort of spills the space right in between these galaxies. And it's these types of processes that I want to talk about today and convince you that you need to pay attention to them if you actually want to interpret the dark matter model, because it turns out that these alter the structure of dark matter inside of galaxies. Okay, I'll put the stick aside for now, I think. All right, so I'll start at the beginning, where most of us are aware that most of the universe is made up of unknown stuff. Of course, most of the energy density in the universe is made up of this stuff, dark energy, and we really have no idea what that is. And I won't mention it again for the rest of the talk, except to say that we include it in the simulations. But today I want to focus on the matter, right? And you can see from the pie chart that most of the matter in the universe is unknown stuff, dark matter. And you and I, right, the stuff that makes up ordinary matter, are just a small slice here. And by the way, I will do that thing that astrophysicists do and refer to ordinary matter as baryons today, right? Lump the entire Standard Model in under baryons. But the point I want to make with this pie chart is the fact that there's so much more dark matter than baryonic matter in the universe has led people like me to run simulations of galaxy formation and just ignore this component, right? You can say, well, there's a lot more of the dark matter. It gravitationally dominates the universe. Whatever the dark matter is doing, the baryons must follow, right? And what I want to convince you today is that that is a wrong assumption to make. Well, on large scales, cold dark matter is a pretty good model, right? So what you're looking at here is a compilation from Lajac et al. Of the power on various size scales in the universe. Right, so this is data from the cosmic microwave background. Sort of in the middle here, you've got clustering of galaxies in the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. And down here at the lowest mass scale is data from the Lyman Alpha Forest at high redshift, tracing the small scale structure there. And the point I want to make is that this dashed line running through here is not a fit, right? It's a prediction of CDM. And so it actually does a really nice job of describing the structure in the universe on large scales. But of course, today what I want to talk about is what happens when you try to go smaller, right? Right around here is something like the Milky Way mass, and it's about those scales and smaller where CDM does not do a very good job. And these are some of the problems that I'll be focusing on today. And I will go through each one of these in detail for those of you who are not completely familiar with these. They are the cusp core problem, the fact that bulgeless disk galaxies exist even, the missing satellites problem, and the newest addition to the bunch, which is known as the too big to fail problem, which really just says that satellites are too dense. Predictions are too dense compared to what we see. So let me explain each one of those. Right, so this is the cusp core problem. And what it basically says is if I run a simulation of any mass, right, be it Milky Way mass galaxy, a dwarf galaxy, a cluster of galaxies, there is always a universal dark matter density profile that comes out of those simulations, and it steeply rises towards the center. Right. So this is commonly referred to as the NFW profile because Navarro, Frank, and White were the first people to point this out. If you, you know, want to come up with the slope here on this plot, alpha is about 1, typically, or minus 1, depending on how you parameterize that. And so that's a real prediction of cold dark matter galaxy formation theory, right? We should be able to test this. We go out to real galaxies. We use the rotation curve of those galaxies. And you know, the mass enclosed tells you is related to how fast that galaxy is rotating. And so if you subtract off the baryonic component and plot up the mass enclosed that's left, you can turn that into a density profile for the dark matter. And what we find often looks like this. Right? completely flat instead of this steeply rising curve. It is easiest to see this in things that are dark matter dominated, right, which will tend to be lower mass dwarf galaxies or low surface brightness galaxies. Now, there are low surface brightness galaxies at many different mass scales, so you can probe this even up to things like Milky Way mass. But in, if you want to try to do this in our own Milky Way, right, you're baryon dominated and this becomes very hard to do. So it is easier in dwarf galaxies, for sure. You know, they don't always look like this, right? Not all galaxies are completely flat. Sometimes they're actually consistent with NFW. Sometimes they're just somewhere in the range in between. But, you know, this says they should always look like this, and they don't. So that's a problem for CDM.
Maybe not. Maybe I went too far. We had Navarro here last week or 2 weeks ago saying this was because we had only dark matter.
That's why I guess what I'm saying today. Part of what I'm saying today, at least. Yeah. All right. So the second problem that I mentioned was the fact that bulgeless disk galaxies exist. So here's an example of what I'm talking about. This is a purely exponential disk all the way to its very center. It is lacking this large central concentration of stars called the bulge. Right. And this is a problem for CDM theory because we think that galaxies get their angular momentum through tidal torques from the large-scale structure. And when we model that, there is always, always a tail of low angular momentum material. We assume the gas and dark matter starts off with the same angular momentum distribution, and that low angular momentum tail goes into forming a bulge at the center. So the fact that these things exist means we're missing that tail of low angular momentum. And actually, I'll show you this in order to quantify this a little bit better. This is data from Van de Bosch et al. In 2001. And what you're seeing in these gray hash regions are angular momentum distributions for the cold gas and stars in local group dwarf galaxies. And the black line is the same in every single panel here, and it is what you expect for a typical cold dark matter halo. So you can see this is the tail of low angular momentum material that I'm talking about. Now, maybe this isn't surprising that they're missing this tail. These are a bunch of bulgeless disk galaxies. But the problem exists even up to Milky Way mass scale. So if you put the Milky Way on this plot, it should have a much bigger bulge than we actually see in the Milky Way. Okay. In terms of the satellites, I'm sure most people are aware of the missing satellites problem, right? Which I'll just figured I'd give the visual impression. Here's a Milky Way mass simulation, Via Lactea. All of these bright points are subhalos around a Milky Way mass galaxy, and there are thousands of them. If we assume they have stars in them, we should be able to go out and count these satellites. That's easier to do in our nearest neighbor, Andromeda, right? Because we're not sitting in the middle of it. And the PANDA survey has been looking for these satellites, and they're up to just over 30 at this point. Right? And we've got about two dozen now in the Milky Way.
But what are the masses of the satellites usually? This is, again, like 10 to the 9.
Well, we're halo mass or stellar mass? That's the trick. I'm going to quote stellar mass here.
Okay.
Draco, which is the faintest of the classical dwarfs, is a few times 10 to the 5 in stellar mass. Right? And you get up to about maybe 10 to the 8 or so in terms of stellar mass in some of these satellites.
Yeah. The problem is that dark matter is put in to get flatness for some galaxies. Not all galaxies show flat rotation curves.
So right.
The issue is that the dark matter doesn't know how to behave. It should stay away from the core.
Well, I guess I'll argue today that it does stay away from the core, right? But we end up with flat rotation curves. So
you don't want flat rotation curves, you said.
You do in dwarf galaxies.
Maybe.
So I think this depends on, like, certainly more massive galaxies, you do see more of a central concentration and a fall off, right? But at lower masses, they don't tend to have that central steep peak. So, all right. So the final problem on that list is the too big to fail problem, and that's what you're looking at here. This is data for the classical dwarf satellites in the Milky Way. This is VMAX, so what they've done here is they've used the velocity dispersions of the dwarfs to turn that into a mass enclosed and the maximum value in the rotation curve as a function of their luminosity. If you assume these are the brightest satellites in the Milky Way, so we often assume that they must also be associated with the most massive things that fell in. If you do that and take a dark matter-only run and ask where would those most massive things lie today, you get these purple points. So they systematically lie above the data. Their Vmax is too high, which means they have too much mass enclosed at a given radius, or they're too dense. And the reason this is the too big to fail problem is that right about here, at about 30 kilometers per second, is generally taken to be the point where you should be massive enough to hold on to baryons even after the reionization of the universe. So these things are too big to have failed to have formed stars. So the question is, where are they?
These spiral dwarf galaxies in the Milky Way would be affected by tidal forces.
So and I will talk a lot about that.
Non-virial objects.
Right.
If you make them non-virial, you can increase the mass to vibration significantly.
Right.
It's not due to dark matter. Necessarily.
I understand that. I'm going to argue today half of what you're arguing, right? That the tidal forces are actually one of the most important parts in making this problem go away. So we should come back to that later. Okay. So the question becomes, right, is CDM wrong? Certainly, all of these issues have caused people to start investigating alternative forms of dark matter to try to explain these small-scale problems. And I will be actually talking about two of the favorite models today, at least favorite in my community, where we are running simulations that involve either warm dark matter or self-interacting dark matter. Okay? So, in terms of warm dark matter, it looks like everything is consistent if warm dark matter was about 3 keV in mass, right? You would actually still preserve the ultrafaints, the small scale structure in the Lyman Alpha forest would not be washed out. And so that is perfectly allowed. I like to think of self-interacting dark matter as the model that tells us that we don't know anything about dark matter, you know, which is pretty true. And it basically says, you know, what if, you know, we've got the standard model on the baryonic side of things, it's very complicated, what if it's just as complicated over in the dark side? And what if there's a mediator particle, right, exchanged between two dark matter particles that come near each other, in which case you can exchange energy between those different dark matter particles. And in these models, where the density is high at the center of galaxies, these interactions exchange, you know, cause heat to transfer outwards from the center, and you turn a cuspy profile into a chord profile. Well, there are many possibilities missing, actually. I'm just focusing on a couple of popular ones.
All
right, and I will not be talking about that today.
Why not?
Because there's only everything in the kitchen sink. You know? Because I chose not to, is basically what it comes down to. All right, so actually, most of what I'll be talking about today is baryons, right? So the 5%. Because all of the problems that I highlighted with galaxy formation theory in cold dark matter are the scales that are dominated by baryonic physics. And all of the problems were pointed out by using dark matter-only simulations that neglected those baryons. Okay. So this is my tool. What you're seeing here is the formation of a Milky Way mass galaxy. We'll not say Milky Way-like, because it probably has a lot more merger activity than the Milky Way did. The greenish-gray is gas, and you'll see these purplish bits. Those are star particles that are color-coded by their age and their metallicity. So blue are young stars, red are old. Right, so we're just focusing here on the region of interest, right, that turns into one massive Milky Way. Actually, the whole box is 50 megaparsecs on a side. I really like this one because of all these interactions here. We start all of these runs at redshifts about, say, 130 or so, and run them all the way to redshift zero. And there are, so what goes into this? So the initial conditions are a uniform mixture of gas and dark matter that's perturbed to have the power spectrum of the CMB. Then you just sort of let gravity do its thing. Nice bar forms here. And we put all of our resolution on one galaxy, on the stuff that ends up inside of one galaxy, so that we can really resolve the central regions of one particular galaxy, right? It has, you know, when the gas gets cold and dense enough, it eventually goes on and forms star particles. Those star particles eventually go supernova, and we deposit thermal energy back into the ISM from those supernovae as well. And what else am I missing with the questions? Not in this one. We do have black holes now, that a prescription for forming black holes in the simulations, but the feedback model has yet to be perfected. Let's put it that way. So no, this one does not have it, but hopefully soon. Other questions?
So what codes are you using? Is this like your code, or do people use out-of-the-box codes?
Right. This is gasoline that you're looking at here. Gasoline is proprietary, actually. It's about to go public, but it has not been public to date. And actually, gasoline is evolving to a new code called Changa. Changa scales much better, actually. So we're hoping to now be able to scale up to many more cores and get to higher resolutions in the same amount of time. And Changa will also be public.
So can I ask a very stupid question? You start off at Z of 150. The baryons are already in stars?
No, just gas.
So when did you say that you form stars? How do you know? You have to follow the baryons?
Yep.
Yep. They cooling? Is there?
Yep, there is a prescription for primordial cooling, metal line cooling, and actually we include the formation, we follow the formation of molecular gas in here.
I see.
Formation and destruction of molecular gas. So there's actually an additional component of cooling due to molecules as well. And so when the gas gets cold and dense enough, that's when it goes on and form, there's a chance it will go on and form stars. And in here, we only allow the star formation to occur in regions where there is molecular gas, like we see in the real universe.
I see. And when do you say that you get supernova?
Right. So every star particle is you know, it's not a real, it's not the mass of one star, right? It's actually 10 to 3, 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 kind of thing. It's generally around 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4 in these simulations.
Ah,
in terms of
solar masses.
Yes.
So these are pretty big stars.
They're pretty big stars, which means...
They represent many a star.
They're born with an IMF. Yeah, we give them a Krupa IMF, and then at every initial mass function that tells you how you populate, you know, low mass stars to up to high mass stars.
Okay.
And then at fixed time steps, we say how many of those stars should have gone supernovae, and we deposit that energy back into the ISM.
I see. Have you checked what happens if you vary that? How sensitive are you to that? To what assumptions you make? Because I would imagine that it makes difference.
Yeah.
If you have a lot of mass concentrated in some star that's 1,000 solar masses, and then it explodes.
Well, it doesn't. It's not 1,000 solar masses that explodes, right? It's you know, it's only like, the O stars have gone supernovae, or a few of the B stars, right? Something. So it's like. It's just a few supernovae that go off in any given time step that you're depositing back. But there are always multiple supernovae that go off.
Yeah.
And their energy actually adds together to create a hot bubble of gas, which is going to become very important for the rest of the talk.
So it doesn't matter what the seed mass is. For the effect that you showed in the beginning,
right.
The seed mass of the star
It's not. It doesn't seem to be important. You can play around with the IMF, and you end up regulating to essentially the same star formation, right? Now, having said that, as we get the higher resolutions, and you're getting down below 1,000 solar masses of a star particle, maybe you shouldn't be fully populating the IMF. And that's something that we want to look into and actually play around with the stochastic IMF in the future.
So
yeah.
When it goes public, would we be able to change the cosmology?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yep. Better question?
Yeah, so what is the IMF?
the initial mass function of stars, it just basically says there's more low mass stars that form than high mass stars. Okay. All right. So I want to talk about why I use this particular tool, right? So these are very high resolution simulations. Actually, what I didn't talk about was how many hours they take to run, which is that galaxy that you just looked at took a million CPU hours to run. So in terms of actual wall clock time, that's like 3 to 6 months to run one galaxy, which means I do not get out a statistical, you know, population. I get a handful of galaxies. I'm up to about 40 these days, which I'm pretty happy with, actually. So why do I do it this way? And this slide is designed to give you a sense of why this is important. This is the same galaxy in both plots here, but the case on the right-hand side should give you a sense of what we've been doing up until about 5 years ago. Okay? And basically, it's really simple. We didn't have as much computing power 5 years ago as we do now, which means we couldn't get to the same high resolutions. Okay, so if you have lower resolutions, you do not resolve high density peaks that form in your galaxies. Okay, so in order to get star formation, you literally wash out the high density peaks. And so in order to get star formation to occur across this whole galaxy, you lower the star formation velocity dense hold. And this red line is a value that was basically universally adopted by simulators, and it's 0.1 AMU per cc, which is ridiculously low compared to real star formation regions, right? But that's what you had to do in order to get atomic mass unit, right? So, yeah. The case, though, on the left is what happens when you can go to higher resolutions. And now you see that you can resolve these high density peaks that sort of stochastically pop up across the disk. And they look a lot like giant molecular clouds. They're concentrations of cold gas, which means that you can now start to make your star formation look more realistic and just restrict stars to forming in these very high density peaks. Okay. Now, that turns out to have changed everything. And the reason is, once you start limiting, right, when a supernova goes off in this gas over here, in this low-density case, right, you've got low densities and sort of warmish gas across your entire ISM. It's very efficient at radiating away the energy. When it's born in those cold, dense peaks and you go supernova, you suddenly deposit all of this energy into something that is really, really cold and dense, and it becomes massively overpressurized. And for the first time, we started driving these galactic winds, right, just by getting to these higher resolutions and restricting the star formation to those higher density peaks. So this is a dwarf galaxy that I'll be talking a lot about today. It's actually sitting here edge on. And this is just a movie at a time when it's had, you know, a big burst of star formation. That creates a hot bubble of gas that, you know, expands out of the disk, and you can see most of these flows are basically perpendicular to the disk. They just take the path of least resistance. And the black line represents the virial radius at this time. Right, so the winds are actually removing a lot of the gas entirely from the galaxy. There is some, you know, recycling, there's some galactic fountain going on, but a lot of the gas really does just leave and not come back. And this is good, right, because we see galactic winds in real galaxies. So this is a bonus. Yeah.
So two questions. First, so your prescription, basically everything that passes the threshold goes to stars completely?
Not everything. There's a probability that it'll go on and form stars. It's like 5%.
Okay, so 5% of things that pass the threshold,
yep,
form a star.
Yep.
And the rest, you just, I mean, they're still above the threshold, so what are you going to do?
It doesn't go on and form stars. Until, well, I mean, you do this every million years. You ask, you know, how much of it. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
And then, so what fraction of, what is, I guess, the baryonic fraction within this?
Right. So at redshift zero, it's lost like 70% of its baryons by the end of this.
And this is for a 10 to the 10 solar mass.
Yeah,
right?
That's right.
So like for something like this,
yeah, it varies. I don't have this plot, but there's a nice trend as a function of galaxy mass. Our Milky Ways only lose about 2 or 3%, you know, not more than about 5% of their baryons.
They never remove much. Okay.
Nope, yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, most of it's sitting in a hot halo. Yeah. Okay. So, I'm going to come back now to those small-scale problems that I talked about earlier, and what I'm going to do is, for the rest of the talk, fill in this, what I call the scorecard. Okay. So I'm going to be talking about each one of these problems and whether or not baryons plus cold dark matter can solve these problems. And I'll also talk about these two other models that I said are popular in galaxy formation theory, which is warm dark matter and self-interacting dark matter. And I want to point out, in both of these cases, I'm not talking about, say, warm dark matter plus baryons. It's just, if I modify just the dark matter, what happens? Well, those outflows are actually very important for solving one of the problems, which is the existence of bulgeous disk galaxies. So that same dwarf galaxy that I just showed you, if I compare it to this data that I showed you earlier, this is what it looks like. Here is the cold gas and stars at the end of the simulation in this dwarf galaxy. And the purple dashed line is the dark matter, the angular momentum distribution of the dark matter halo. And so, just like the real data, right, it's missing this Lowing momentum tail. And what I really like about SPH simulations is that I can follow the particles that have been blown out of the galaxy as well and ask, what was their angular momentum before they got kicked out? And if you do that, you get this red line. And so the baryons in the dark matter did start off with the same angular momentum distribution initially, but then you modify the baryonic distribution and you end up with kicking out all the Lowing momentum material and forming no bulge, essentially. So on the scorecard, baryons solve that problem, but there's actually nothing I can do to the dark matter that would solve that problem, right? There is no, I mean, not that I'm aware of at least, there is no dark matter model that preferentially removes low angular momentum gas from galaxies. Right, so maybe this will...
You mean this is baryonic gas?
Baryonic gas. It's got to get rid of the baryonic material. Yeah. And so there's nothing you can do there. It's pretty hard. Right? So if you want to make bulgeous disk galaxies, you need baryonic feedback, really, is what it comes down to. Turns out that those winds were also intimately tied with the creation of a dark matter core. So this is that same dwarf galaxy again. This is the dark matter density profile. And as it starts there at high redshift, you can see it initially starts off very steep, right? It looks like an NFW profile. And it's with time that it becomes less and less steep and turns into a chord profile. And I'll explain why that is in a minute, but I just wanted to point out that over here on this plot are some observations of real dwarf galaxies. This is data from the THINGS survey, the H1 nearby galaxy survey. And so all of these points here are observed dwarf galaxies where they've actually resolved the inner kiloparsec. And the gray lines up there are what you would expect if they had NFW profiles. And essentially, none of them do. They all look cored. And also on here, in the yellow and green, are two of my simulated dwarfs. And they actually do a really nice job of matching the slope seen in the observational data. So the reason this happens is because of that feedback. So this is that same dwarf that I've been talking about, and we are now looking at it face on and at pretty high redshift. And this is a map of the gas density. So this here is just a big hole at the center of the galaxy. It's a point right after some supernovae have gone off and they've created a hot bubble of gas. That hot bubble of gas wants to rapidly expand, and it does, and in fact, it expands faster than the dynamical time at the center of that galaxy. Right. Now, interestingly, the gas and dark matter densities at the center of that dwarf are comparable at this time. So when that gas suddenly gets removed by expanding in this hot bubble, it actually flattens the gravitational potential well at the center of that dwarf. Right, which basically means, you know, you flatten the potential well, the dark matter has to react, and the orbits actually expand. So later, this gas can cool back to the center, but But then it just does this again. It keeps undergoing this bursty star formation, and it keeps pushing more and more dark matter out of the center and transforming that cuspy profile into a chord profile. So it's purely a gravitational interaction with the potential well.
Size of a supernova shell?
Yeah.
Or,
yeah.
So that's a bunch of
that's actually what this plot is sort of getting at. This is just a test of this model. This is like a dark matter particle that starts off at 0.1 kiloparsec. And given the star formation history of this dwarf, it migrates outward towards 1 kiloparsec. But you can see the stuff that formed, or that was initially at about 1 kiloparsec, does not move. Right? So this fluctuation is happening in the inner kiloparsec. And so it's really just you end up creating about 1 kiloparsec size cores in these galaxies.
And that's sort of regardless of the size of the halo?
We think, yeah. That's not clear entirely. Let me get to this slide maybe, which talks about function of halo mass, and I'll come back to that. These are results showing core formation as a function of halo mass. And so that's halo mass here on the x-axis. This is actually the ratio of the amount of stars formed to the halo mass. And it's color-coded by the dark matter density slope. So right about here, right, there's this range where galaxies are really, really good at forming dark matter cores. And it's basically because they have shallow potential wells and this bursty star formation history. As you go down to lower masses, you do not have this repeated burst of star formation. You have less and less efficiency in star formation. Some of these guys, you know, they'll have like one burst of star formation and then they just lose all their baryons. So they don't have dark matter core formation. And as you go up to the Milky Way, it looks like it gets harder as well, okay? Where now you've got a deeper potential well, it's harder to fluctuate, and plus you've got gas in that deeper potential well that's very, very cold and dense, and it can quickly radiate away the energy from the supernova, and it's just hard to get the same fluctuation. Now, having said that, this plot was made with simulations that measure the slope down to about 2 kiloparsecs in a Milky Way mass galaxy. Right, so this does not preclude something else going on interior to about 2 kiloparsecs. There could be core formation inside that, as far as I'm concerned. And likewise, down here, as you go to lower and lower mass halos, maybe as you have less and less star formation, you just make smaller and smaller cores. So rather than getting 1 kiloparsec, you get something smaller and smaller. But if that's true, I don't resolve it yet. So I hope so. I hope so, yeah.
Okay.
We're aiming for it, yeah.
Yeah.
Globular clusters in our Milky Way, dense objects.
Mm-hmm.
And the dispersion velocities are all Newtonian. Where's the dark matter?
Oh, I didn't say those things had dark matter. I'm totally agnostic about globular clusters. I don't know that they ever had dark matter. I don't know if they had dark matter and got stripped away. I can't resolve anything like that. Therefore, I certainly wouldn't say anything about it. And I think people who study study globular clusters are heroic, right? Because you've been studying them for like 100 years and you still don't understand their formation. So I don't know. I don't know if they ever had dark matter or not.
But they don't show it.
No, I agree.
Ten to the nine solar mass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I don't know if they were ever in a dark matter halo.
Next to these dwarf galaxies.
Sure. Yeah.
So
it doesn't mean that they started with a dark matter halo, though. Maybe they formed in some dense portion of the galaxy during mergers at high redshift. I have no idea.
I was going to ask when people quote the cusp core problem, does that fall in your blue band here? In terms of the masses of galaxies.
Right, yeah. So these are things that are dark matter dominated. So again, it's easier, right, to get the dark matter densities in those. And as you're up here, right, these things are very baryon dominated. And so it's harder to make a statement about that.
Is that
in general, in fact, I think that's actually my next slide. Now, maybe this, maybe there's more data we could be comparing to, but this actually compares the predictions to the observations. In terms of, these are the things galaxies, again, because they resolve the inner kiloparsec so well, they're sort of the favored data set. And the red symbols are the simulations, and you can see, you know, so far it looks like we are matching that data pretty well.
So this is with bodies, simulations with bodies.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So what was the curve there? I missed that.
This one?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is what you'd expect if they were all NFW. This is the,
oh, okay.
So it approaches a slope of about minus one, right? But they're all less dense than that. Okay. So does warm dark matter create cores? It was thought initially that it might, because the leading candidate for warm dark matter would be a sterile neutrino, which is a fermion, and there's a limit to how many fermions you can cram into a given area due to phase space considerations. So this is a simulation from Andrea Macho et al., where they looked at the core size that you would get from warm dark matter as a function of the mass of the particle, and that's a thermal relic mass, by the way. And the point, the real point is that we see roughly kiloparsec-sized cores in dwarf galaxies. So in order to get that, you would need a mass for the neutrino, the sterile neutrino, of about 0.1 keV. And that is already like completely ruled out, right, by the fact that the ultrafaints exist, by the fact, by the small-scale structure in the Lyman alpha forest. That all says you've got to be greater than about 3 keV, right? It essentially means you get no core formation whatsoever from warm dark matter. So can't, that can't work.
Does can something work? Sorry, can you have a very light? There's another way to erase structure at small scale. It's not just warm dark matter. You have a very light scalar particle. There is a scale below which it cannot collapse. Have you seen this paper by, it's called Cold and Fuzzy Dark Matter by Andrei Grudnov, which was written in 2001. So if you have a scalar particle, that has, when I talk about mass, I'm talking about 10 to minus 20 eV mass.
Okay.
Which quantum wave performance.
So you have an axions, right?
Axions, yeah. It could be
okay.
any boson. That
okay.
has the, yeah, you care about boson statistics. Because now you go to a regime for a bosonic particle, there's not a space space.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Right. Oh, that makes sense. Yeah, okay.
So have you looked at all how those might work? Because then you have, so there is, if you cannot collapse now for bosons, there is still, let's say, call it the phase, but you cannot collapse at scales smaller
yeah.
than you do probably wavelength.
Yeah. So I'll probably touch on this again later, but
yeah.
you could definitely look into this.
Yeah.
I actually just don't see much point. And
yeah.
the reason I don't see much point is because
yeah.
running these simulations
mm-hmm.
Is very, very expensive. And really what you're going to do is you're going to find limits that still, for instance, make ultrafaint dwarfs and match the Lyman alpha forest data.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so you can put limits on models like this, but in terms of saying is it the correct model, it
no,
doesn't
no,
help
I'm
at all.
No, I'm saying that warm dark matter won't do this, but this is something that can do this from
right.
ordinary dark matter
right.
without having to add any interaction.
Right.
This is just
fair enough. Yeah, yeah. I just don't know if I want to run a million CPUR simulation doing it.
Yeah. I mean, that's easy. Yeah. No, because it's not excluded.
Yeah. yeah, right. I'm sure it's not excluded. Yeah, yeah. So, yeah. yeah.
The new Planck data has put a new type bound on the number of neutrinos. It seems to exclude sterile neutrinos.
No, that's only if you're talking about a fourth generation. That's just a bound on an effective. It's not talking about KV scale.
So what about sterile neutrinos?
Not
what's
ruled out.
Fourth?
If they're heavier, if they're heavy enough, they're not ruled out.
Because they have to be, in order to have a bundle ineffective, it has to be like radiation at the time where at temperatures of the CMB. And these are much heavier. By the time you reach the CMB, these are already 100 dB particles already non relativistic.
Yep, yep. Do you have a question? Or is your hand just. Oh, okay. All right. So let me move on to self-interacting dark matter and ask, does it create cores? And of course, the answer is yes. That's basically why it was invented, right? You've got this scattering in the center of the galaxy that pushes the central dark matter out and transforms this cusp into a core. So if I come back to my scorecard, this is where we're at. SIDM and baryons can both now create cores inside of galaxies.
So when you say self-interacting, what do you actually mean?
I'm generally talking about something that is still cold, like a WIMP, but now has some sort of mediator particle that can be exchanged.
It's not long range, though. You're still
What's the range?
It's contact.
It's elastic scattering.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay, so now I'm going to turn to the satellites issues, right, and talk about tidal forces. So something else that happens when you include baryons in a simulation is that you get things that look like this, right, like a disk. You don't get that in a dark matter Elniron. Now, it doesn't have to be a disk. The whole point is that you take some component of your matter that can now cool, and so it will cool to the center of the halo, unlike in a dark matter Elniron. And so you actually put more mass at the center of a dark matter halo when you include baryons than when you do not include baryons. Right. And this was the effect of the, so let me back up and just say then, once you do that, right, and so let's say you form a Milky Way galaxy and now it has more mass sitting at the center, once a satellite enters and starts orbiting, the tidal forces on that satellite become stronger. And Henya Rubia et al. Showed this really nicely with some isolated models. These are results from idealized simulations where they took satellites and they threw them into a Milky Way potential. And each one, these are four different satellites in each case here, and they're color-coded based on their dark matter density slope. So the black and red are things that I would call NFW-like. They're very steep central profiles. The blue and green are cored, what I would call cored, pretty much shallower than NFW. And these are just different paracentric passages, so the things up top don't come very close to the center of their parent halo. These get much, much closer to the center of the halo. And they just orbit these as if, you know, over many, many giga years, and they look at the final mass compared to the mass when the thing fell in. And so you can take away from this plot that the closer you get to the center of the halo, the more mass you lose in tidal stripping. Gamma. That's what I was calling alpha earlier.
Ah,
it's the slope of the dark matter density problem.
So this is the slope inside the object?
Inside the satellite.
Yeah. Okay.
Not the parent halo, but just the satellite. And you can see, right, down here, these cored profiles lose more mass than their cuspy profile counterparts. Okay. But this case is without a disk on the left-hand side. And the case on the right-hand side is what happens when you include a disk that's about 10% of the total halo mass. And in that case, actually, nearly every single satellite will lose more mass because of this disk potential. And if you are cored, you will really lose a lot more mass.
How big is the satellite compared to the halo?
Oh, I don't know if I remember off the top of my head. It's probably something like 100 or 1,000 times less massive, but I don't remember. I'd have to look that up.
The problem is that these dwarf galaxies are moving elliptical orbits.
Yep.
So some of them, most of them, get near the center
yep.
at some point.
Yep.
They get tidally
right.
distorted, so that they're no longer satisfied the virial theorem.
Right, and they can be puffed up, essentially,
so
tidally heated.
You can do simulation to show the master migration increases. You can prove
right.
This.
Oh, and Penny Rubia has done that,
right.
Yeah.
So this
yeah.
is what you're showing.
Yeah, that, but that, and this is the dark matter mass. So that happens. The stellar orbits can get expanded through tidal heating, but this is just the mass of the dark matter halo at the end of the simulation compared to when it fell in. And so that's a different thing entirely. Right. So essentially, you know, as you said, the closer you get to the center of the galaxy, the more mass you lose. If you are cored, you lose a lot more mass. And if you take that into account, you can solve the too-big-to-fail problem. All right, so here again, on the right-hand side, is the too-big-to-fail problem. Now, in red is the Milky Way dwarf spheroidal data, and in blue, I've added M31 dwarf spheroidals. And the black points are data from two Milky Way mass simulations, but they are dark matter only. And you can see this is the too big to fail problem, right? They sit systematically above the observational data. if I just take those same two simulations, run them with baryons, this is the result I get. Now all the satellites have lost mass due to tidal stripping in the presence of a disk. Okay, so these black circles here are true dwarf spheroidal analogs. They have zero gas at the end of the simulation. These still have some gas, and it's not clear if that might be a numerical artifact. But.
So dwarfs, like Fornax, have a normal mass denier ratio of around 1 or 2. So it means that not all of them are kind of distorted.
Fornax. All right, so there's actually two regimes on this plot. Let's see if this helps. Down here, okay, roughly down around here, these satellites did not have enough star formation to create a core. So all of the change in mass, you know, from here down to here, is strictly due to tidal stripping in the presence of a disk, but you're still a cuspy halo. Up here, these satellites have had enough star formation that they undergo core creation before they even get accreted onto the Milky Way halo. And because they are cored, they're less tightly bound, they lose a lot more mass in tidal stripping. So they start off like really high up there and can come down even further. So this thing would have lost a lot of mass.
That's one
this model would have said that Fornax had lost a lot of mass. Yeah, I agree.
So are you troubled by those open circles? Or?
No, not really.
Why
this
not?
Is before. A few years ago, it was pointed out that most SPH simulations do not capture what Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities and RAM pressure stripping correctly. And they've all since had updates, but this was before those updates. And so they actually hold on to their gas longer than they should now with the updates. So I think it's just purely numerical.
So you're saying the correct, if you do a different, if you don't do SPH, or I guess you correct SPH, is that?
Yeah.
Okay. Then they're going to lose their gas, is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, the goal is to rerun these simulations now, and hopefully we'll see that they have lost those gas. But I also want to run it at a higher resolution too, so we're gonna balance. Okay. Does warm dark matter solve the too big to fail problem? And the answer actually is yes. And this is because in warm dark matter, structure formation occurs later. That's what this plot up here shows, is cold dark matter and warm dark matter satellites formed around a Milky Way mass halo. And as a function of their redshift of formation, and the warm dark matter stuff forms later. You wipe out the small-scale structure formation happens later. And we know that there is a tight correlation between when you form and how dense you are. So the later you form, the less dense you are. And so because you are less dense, right, that's the too big to fail problem, you're too dense. So warm dark matter can start to solve the too big to fail problem. And here are results from simulations from Schneider et al. This is the cold dark matter case. These are all the big massive failures that don't match the data at all. And this is what happens as you change to these warm dark matter masses. And so, you know, in here-ish, you can start to match the data. Can self-interacting dark matter solve this problem? And I say it depends on who you ask. And the reason I say that is because these authors said that it can. And I say it probably doesn't. All right. So what you're looking at here is, again, the massive failures of CDM are in this black line. And they do not match the data. And then everything else on here is a self-interacting dark matter model. Let's see. Three of them, purple, yellow, and red, are constant velocity cross-sections of various magnitude. And the two blue and green ones have vary as a function of velocity. This is 0.1 centimeter squared per gram, and it is not enough of a cross-section to match the data. You don't get enough interactions. The red case over here has already been ruled out. Right? This is a 10 centimeter per squared centimeter squared per gram cross-section. And if the cross-section was that high, clusters of galaxies would be more spherical than we actually see. So that's already been ruled out. But all of these models in here do an okay job of matching the data. The reason I'm not convinced is because of this guy, Fornax. Right? So Fornax is the brightest of the classical dwarf spherules, which means we assume usually that it starts off in one of the most massive halos at like 40 or 50 kilometers per second. And what it's doing down here at 20 is yet to be explained by these models. And so that worries me quite a bit. Right. But if you break the assumption that the brightest things have to be sitting in the biggest things, then my argument falls apart, and they all would solve the too big to fail problem. Okay, so I give it to them. All right, so let me get to the missing satellites problem. So those processes that I talked about earlier with the baryonic tidal effects alter the velocity function and the luminosity function predictions for satellites around a Milky Way. If you focus here on the luminosity function, this is what you expect in dark matter only models in the solid red. And the open circles are what happens when you include these tidal effects from the disk. And the plot up top is the ratio between the two. So the whole point really is that you kill off about a third of the massive satellites, the luminous satellites around a Milky Way, which is a lot, you know, a third of the luminous satellites. And we tested this by applying it to Via Lactea. So here is, if you take all the satellites in the Halo catalog in Via Lactea at reg of zero and assign them a luminosity, this is what they look like. And so right about here is how bright Draco is. Draco is the faintest of the classical dwarfs. And in the Milky Way, there are about 10 satellites brighter than Draco. And in Via Lactea, there are more than 100. So that is a missing satellites problem right there. And a lot of people are under the impression that reionization solves this problem, that most of the halos are just not unable to form stars. You've got a whole bunch of dark halos wandering around. We took that into account, and that gives you all of these empty satellites here. Right? So it does kill off a lot of star formation in those satellites. But you're left, actually, with all of these up here, which is way more luminous galaxies or satellites than we see around the Milky Way. So reionization alone actually does not solve the problem. But then we took into account most of these are massive enough to have a core, and they all came within 20 kiloparsecs of the center of the halo at some point, which means they underwent a lot of tidal stripping, like more than 99, I think it was more than 98% total halo mass loss. And we said, you know what, those would have been totally destroyed. And so we put the little X's through them. And so what we're left with is the red ones, which have the velocities and luminosities that look like the Milky Way or M31.
Sorry to keep interrupting. It's also the Tully Fisher model.
We match the Tully Fisher.
The flat, the average flat partition curves versus magnitude.
Yep.
It's very precise in a straight line.
Yep.
The dark matter.
Can we come back to this actually at the very end, and I'll show you a plot. I skipped it due to time constraints here, because I am really running out of time and I want to finish this up. Warm dark matter can of course solve the missing satellites problem. It kills off Smalskill structure. What you're seeing here is results from Polosensky and Riccati, where they made a correction to the ultrafaint dwarfs. They said, okay, assuming we haven't seen all of them yet, how many should there be as a function of distance in the Milky Way, and they concluded that a warm dark matter particle of about 2 keV or so is still consistent with the data. In SIDM, it actually, all of these models do not modify the subhalo mass function. So in CDM, it's buried under here in black, and all of these SIDM models have the same subhalo mass function. They don't destroy any of the satellites. The only one that does is this one that has already been ruled out due to cluster shapes. So if I come back to the scorecard, this is what it looks like. This is where we stand, right? With baryons potentially solving all of these problems. I said this at lunch for those of you who are there, but a lot of people look at this and have said, okay, then that's it. I don't need to worry about these alternative models. I'm good with cold dark matter plus baryons. And that is not actually the message that I want to give, okay? So baryons exist, right? And they are important. And they are the only way, in fact, to create bulge disk galaxies. But I do not see any reason why it couldn't be self-interacting dark matter plus baryons or warm dark matter plus baryons.
Back to the one.
Why don't we just let finish the question
then? Yeah. I will skip through a number of these slides here. I just wanted to point out that the way forward is to first run those alternative dark matter models with baryons. And also, since we now have several methods of creating cores, to run, to try to figure out really what is the role of supernova feedback. Can we put limits on how much core formation can happen from supernovae? So I will just skip most of these and highlight a few points, which is here is a nice dwarf galaxy, if you focus on these blue and red lines, that undergoes lots and lots of core creation thanks to baryons. And if I run the same model with self-interacting dark matter plus baryons, they look identical. All right, so it turns out that CDM plus baryons and SIDM plus baryons basically look the same, which says to me that self-interacting dark matter is perfectly allowed according to all observations at the moment. And so I think I will probably just end there and leave up my conclusion. Thank you.
I think that last point is very interesting because
yes, I
when
am.
You say your take-home point is that you know, these things are perfectly allowed, but on the other hand, I mean, if in structure formation there really is no akin to the model being, you know, cold dark matter or self-interacting dark matter, or whatever, then really there is no point in working on these models, right? Because you'll never be able to distinguish them
right.
Anyways. So I mean, can you come
yep.
up with things that are distinguishable?
Yep. One of the things that I had to skip. Okay. What you're seeing here are satellite predictions. This is my work here with cold dark matter plus baryons. And these are density profiles for something like Draco, right? So again, the faintest of the classical dwarf spherules. And Draco does not have enough star formation to make a dark matter core. Right? So the dark matter and the baryonic runs essentially have the same density profile. But here is Draco in the SIDM models, and it should have a core, right? So there, on those scales, we're starting to see some differences between these two models. And Matt Walker is actually collecting, you know, thousands of stars in Draco to try to answer this question, to use it as a first test of these two models. So yeah, we're trying to come up, you know, we're gonna run with baryons now and try to make more predictions for how these things vary and whether or not we can rule out one model or another.
So there's a sweet spot in the range of scales.
Looks like. Yeah, unfortunately, it's really faint.
Right.
Yeah.
And is there a physical way of understanding why that particular scale? Like, could I a priori predicted, okay, well, I should look at this X max halos?
Most people probably would have thought it was a little bit higher, mm-hmm. right? So, like, in a 10 to the 8 stellar mass halo, where baryons are very good at making cores, and you would add self-interacting dark matter, you might expect really, really big cores, but what we're finding is that that's not the case, that baryons seem to be acting like a glue, mm-hmm. essentially, that are holding the dark matter together. So, no, people did not predict that.
Yeah.
Kelly Fisher?
Possibility of left out.
Yep.
All of these problems are resolved if you have no dark matter and modified matter. In the present universe.
There we go. I'm going to. So let me first answer your question about Tully Fisher. Right. So here is the Tully Fisher relationship, the baryonic Tully Fisher relationship. So here's data from Stacy McGough. Very nice tight relationship, as you said. Here is the relation from my simulations, and they do a really nice job of matching this. I'm headed to KS Western to work with Stacy and try to understand why this is happening. But I think that it's really, you know, in a modified gravity model, which I'm not an expert in, my understanding is basically the shape of the profile depends on the baryonic component, right? How much baryons are there. That falls out of this because now you've got core formation varying with the amount of star formation that you've had occur, which varies, you know, which varies with halo mass, which varies with baryonic mass. And so you do seem to get...
Follows the medium.
Yeah, it seems to fall out.
And also it solves these other problems for obvious reasons, because you're not fighting dark matter all the time.
Right.
Right. So why is this not considered more?
I'm trying to get the message out.
This is a sociological problem.
No, I think John is saying, why modified gravity is
not... Oh, is not considered more?
Yeah.
Oh. Oh, because there's other reasons to believe that dark matter exists, right? There's many orthogonal routes of evidence
it's
that suggest that dark matter exists.
Well, you can't fit that in the universe. Structure growth without some type of...
Right.
The present universe gets into trouble.
And decaying dark matter is another model that's on the rise, actually, in popularity, too. So,
okay, let's think out.
Thank you.